Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and I'd love to tell you about my podcast, Dare to Lead. Innovation, creativity, building a better, more just world, all of these things require absolutely courageous leadership, especially given the complexity and chaos of the world right now. The Dare to Lead podcast is a collection of conversations with change catalysts, culture shifters, some troublemakers, folks who are really daring to create and change the world. I hope you join us.
Really, we should just do a whole episode on Smells Like Teen Spirit.
Is Jerusalem old enough for that? I don't think that it's fair to ask her to do something from before she was born.
I don't even know what you're talking about. Is that a song?
Oh my God, no.
See, we need to play the song and then she can give an objective view.
It's the famous it's the Nirvana song that you've heard if you've heard one Nirvana song.
Gotcha. Lit.
See? Okay. Welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with ProPublica's Dara Lind, and Jerusalem Demsas is back with us. Dara and I really wanted to do a show just about the lyrics, Just Smells Like Teen Spirit, and whether it's worthy of cancellation in retrospect. But Jerusalem is so young, she doesn't even know that song. And so instead, we are going to talk about some recent mass shootings that have occurred. In Boulder, we don't, I think, know any details as of Tuesday morning when we are recording, other than that there are 10 victims and seemingly, you know, the use of you never want to get the technical details wrong in these shootings or the pro-gun people get upset at you. But I think like one of the big guns that liberals
initial reports indicate that an AR-15 was used. And I think that if it turns out to not be correct, then the people who have technical expertise should go after the people doing the initial reporting and not us poor podcasters.
Right. Yes. But it means that gun control is possibly back in the discourse. Although I note that leading Democratic politicians seem to be not doing that, right? That like there are different ways you can respond to these different kinds of events. And, you know, like Joe Biden, who is an advocate of assault weapons ban, you know, was a pioneer of that in the early 90s, endorsed it on the campaign. But like the White House is not out with a gun regulation forward message today, which I frankly think is probably correct. I think we've seen this discourse around guns and spree shootings many times before, and it doesn't take us anywhere. Like it doesn't achieve anything that proponents of stronger gun regulation would want.
Yeah, I was really hoping that we were discussing an episode before last night, thinking mostly about the spree shooting in Atlanta last week. But, you know, it seems to me that the kind of public discourse around spectacularly horrifying news events has really, in the case of mass shootings, kind of settled into this very rote place where there are activists on the left who demand a particular policy response. There are conservatives who will try to block out the discussion of a policy response by saying not the right time or like, you know, senseless violence or thoughts and prayers and that kind of thing. All of that has become a little bit memeified. And as the Weeds, I was looking at the variation of this, which wasn't exactly the same, but did kind of bear certain important resemblances in the reaction to the Atlanta shootings, and going, gee, maybe it's time for people to start thinking about what are the particular policy responses that are being put forward, and are they responsive to the nature of the events? And like, conversely, is doing policy push by reaction to spectacular news events really the right move? Like, Democrats appear to be, you know, at least in the like 12 hours since the Boulder shooting or whatever, making the calculation that, you know, Joe Biden is trying to put together his big infrastructure package. Democrats have unified but very tenuous control of the legislature and a whole lot of legislative activities, that this might not be the time to drop everything and do a gun control bill, quote unquote, instead. But that's a theory of when you should, in the words of Rahm Emanuel, waste a crisis, so to speak, that I think deserves to be unpacked a little bit more.
I also think, though, that a lot of the reason why we see a lot of, insufficient policy response, or at least policy responses that don't actually deal with the underlying issue about why America has so many gun deaths, is because there's just paralysis on actually getting it done. Like, the reality is that there's only very few policy responses that would actually deal with the gun problem. And that has to do with either a buyback program. I mean, an assault weapons ban would do some, but not a lot. But essentially, what research tells us is that places with more guns have more gun deaths, and America has more private gun ownership than anyone else. And I mean, I think the next highest one is like Yemen, and they're at like, you know, not even a third of what we have in terms of private gun ownership. So I think there's a clear problem here where like no one is willing to actually do the thing that would actually stop people from dying. And, you know, maybe that's a political calculation that everyone should make, and that we need to like realize that most Americans are not willing to give up what they view as an essential freedom for this. But it seems like that's never actually explicitly being stated. Instead, we're saying things like, no, if we have this universal background check program, or if we do this other incremental policy, that's actually going to get there. And it feels weird to me, because what if we actually did pass universal background checks, and then we continue to have like the same number, or, you know, still an insanely high number of gun deaths per year? I mean, at that point, do we then realize that like, oh, we need to talk about how a lot of this has to do with suicide, and a lot of these are actually handgun deaths? I think it's like 70-80% of all shootings are done with handguns and not with assault weapons. So, I mean, there's a level here of which we have to, where like people are not being, I think, truly genuine, but I don't actually fully blame them, because to be genuine would be political suicide in a lot of cases. So it's really hard to tell what's going on there.
Can you actually just unpack that a little bit more, Jerusalem? I mean, like, we're kind of backing into the, you know, the insufficiency of policy responses, but can you maybe just talk through a little bit what the solutions would be if you construed gun deaths as the problem versus if you construed mass shootings as the problem?
Yeah. I mean, if gun deaths were the problem, the answer would be get as many guns off the street. And the problem is that most people have this sense that mass shootings are a much larger part of gun deaths than they actually are. I think in 2019, it was like 2% of gun deaths were mass shootings, which are shootings that have four or more people who are killed at one time. And, you know, I don't think most people realize that. When I'm talking to friends and family of mine, I think their understanding of gun deaths in America is that mass shootings take up a much larger proportion of what's going on here. And that has to do with of course, they're tragic and horrible events, and the randomness is really shocking for folks because it feels like it's completely out of control. But when we're talking about the 39,000 or so gun deaths that happen per year, the actual response here is just that unless you're going to take these guns off the street, nothing's really going to change about that. And then there's a secondary question here too of like, are people actually only interested in stopping mass shootings? Is that the only thing people are actually really traumatized by, and that they're willing to allow like the level of suicides to continue, the level of individual deaths to continue at the hands of people who are just shooting individuals, or who are just escalating conflicts that may not have been lethal but just violent? So I think there's so many questions here that are never actually addressed because no one wants to really delve into the details. But we still take on or at least Democrats and Republicans still take on the political cost of having this conversation without actually getting any action done at the end of the day, which is to me just a really strange cycle. And maybe this time Democrats are just like not going to engage on this. But then they fall into the trap again of all of their supporters getting mad at them for saying things like thoughts and prayers. So it's like, do you lie to your supporters and tell them universal background checks are going to work? Or do you just say thoughts and prayers? Like, it's just a calculation that no one's willing to really stand by.
But, you know, I mean, I think that is all completely correct. But then I think it becomes a question of like, how do you construct the problem? Right. And so Democrats had, I think, a long era of political success from 2006 through 2012 of construing deaths by gunfire as a big problem. Right. And then like a big problem that they were not going to solve by like draining the swamp of firearms. And so then different aspects of the problem could be addressed in different kinds of ways, right? Like there are a lot of different things that lead to fewer people shooting each other, some of which relates to the availability of guns and some of which relates to other things. Then politicians who were from more progressive areas could like also say, oh, I think it's bad that we have all these guns. After Sandy Hook, right? Sandy Hook was so spectacular. And it was so emotionally compelling to relatively privileged people who feel isolated from violence and social problems. And it came at a time when violent crime as a whole was at its lowest level in generations, right? It punctured the gun politics for Democrats to make them say, we need to do something, not about like the quantity of people who are shot in America, which was still large, even at a historic low point, but about like this specific risk that affluent suburban school children could be gunned down for absolutely no reason. But it turns out that it's really hard to address that problem without like totally eradicating gun ownership, because you get these measures that poll well, right? Like background checks, et cetera, et cetera. But it's not like the famous ones. The famous re-killings are almost never carried out by someone who would have flunked a background check. Exactly what makes these things so terrifying to people is that they like don't involve career criminals beefing with each other over various things, right? But like, there's no background check system that adjudicates for like the formerly law-abiding person who hasn't been in the system doing something quote unquote crazy. I mean, I don't want to prejudge the mental health factors, but something so unexpected, right? Like that's not something that these measures would prevent. But then you get into this politically toxic terrain where you would have, you know, on the one hand, Obama saying, well, we need this Manchin-Toomey bill on background checks. But like the people who it's a minority of the public, the people who like own and use long firearms and are enthusiastic about them, but they know a lot about guns and gun regulation. And they know perfectly well that these measures won't stop the problem that they're supposed to stop. And that if they perceive there as being political momentum to create a situation in which it's not possible for a person to obtain a long gun and shoot up a school, that that does in fact threaten their legitimate hobby, right? Whereas other kinds of things, right, like some kind of like law enforcement crackdown on cheap, easily concealed handguns actually doesn't threaten gun hobbyist interests in the same kind of way if you can come up with a way to do it. Although what's interesting is that progressives have been moving in the opposite direction. You know, like there was I read a New Republic article that published January 2020. It was about how Larry Krasner was going to like really solve gun violence in Philadelphia by not prosecuting gun possession charges as felonies. I think that has not worked out super well for Philadelphia. I mean, it's interesting, right? I mean, progressives have gotten hesitant about like very punitive law enforcement type solutions. But obviously, like, that's how you would get guns out of people's hands, is with some kind of, like, you would have to take them somehow.
Sorry, I just want to say one thing on what Matt said about mental health. It's just that there's a 2015 study that shows that, like, you know, I think they looked at a database of, like, 235 killers, and they found that only, like, 20% of them were in any way identified as having a mental health issue. So, like, I mean, I know that's not what you were saying, Matt, but just to be clear, I think a lot of people think that mental health is like another way, an avenue to get at this problem. But it's, there's just like no evidence that that's actually the case. And it's just more evidence that people are yearning to find a politically salient solution to a problem that the solutions are not politically salient.
Right. Yeah. I mean, no, I mean, that's right.
I do want to make sure that we're disambiguating policy solutions that would reduce the supply of guns, in the proactive sense, or in the making it more difficult to obtain a gun sense, from policy solutions that would retrospectively increase penalties for ownership or use of illegal guns, because the efficacy questions there are different, the equities there are different. I think that's something that is also, you know, like that I think we're going to be talking about a little bit more in a slightly different context, focusing more on Atlanta. But, you know, what Matt was saying about the politics of Sandy Hook really did kind of unlock something for me. Like, there's a Twitter meme that America decided that it wasn't going to do anything about gun violence when Sandy Hook happened and the Senate didn't act. That, like, that was the point at which it became clear that even the most horrifying thing wouldn't motivate action. And, you know, in retrospect, with the narrative that Matt was giving, I think that it's worth kind of reframing that. Like, Sandy Hook was the moment at which Democrats and the Democratic coalition decided that the biggest spurs to act were acts of spectacular and not obviously predicted violence, and that Republicans decided that that wasn't necessarily a sufficient cause for them to compromise on principle. Like, that's definitely the moment where the current politics of guns originated. If that was a path-breaking moment for Democrats as much as it was for Republicans in construing the mass shooting as the kind of thing that gun control measures were supposed to prevent. And I think a lot, and have been thinking a lot for a while because of my beat on the politics of fear, and when politicized fears interact with how people actually are going about living their daily lives. And this is a tricky thing to talk about because you want to, in general, not overly validate things that are objectively irrational or paranoid. But on the other hand, you don't want to be using kind of relative risk statistics to invalidate lived experiences. And like, that's, you know, it's worth just being very upfront that like, that's hard. But it has been interesting for me to see and this has gotten, I think, a little bit more muted over the last several years as for mostly unrelated reasons, white progressives have become a little more circumspect about at least publicly stating that they feel that they are the ones most at risk in any given situation. But for a while, it really did seem like there was a population of people who were feeling themselves personally like they had trouble going about their daily lives, or were going about their daily lives with the understanding that they were at a worth considering risk of being gunned down in a mass shooting. And that's the kind of scenario where politicians and certainly other kind of politically enfranchised elites such as media have to think a little bit about, are we making clear where the biggest problem is? Are we making clear who the most likely groups are to be targeted, to be affected by this? Or are we creating a situation in which we are allowing the unusualness of a mass shooting to dictate our coverage in a way that is going to make it appear more usual than it is, and actually, you know, make people worry about something that in terms of objective risk might not be the thing that they would choose to worry about?
And even the verbiage, right, like the phrase mass shooting, right, has always been challenging to operationalize, because people will say, well, like, what makes a mass? And they'll get some number and they'll say, well, it's a mass if you shoot four people, say. But then when you go statistically, like, the bulk of incidents in which four or more people are shot turn out to not be like media narrative, quote unquote, mass shootings. They are instead, quote unquote, ordinary crime that would be a local story, right? Like, a guy drives by, he shoots at four people because he's trying to kill somebody he's in a feud with, and a stray bullet kills a child. That would be a really big local news story, right? But like the national quote unquote mass shooting script is a very like racially and class sort of bound concept, right? That it becomes challenging as like a policy writer. It's like as a person who uses the English language and participates in society, like I know what people mean by a mass shooting versus ordinary crime, but it's like difficult as a policy writer to even operationalize that and like say what the difference is exactly. And there's a media mode. I mean, Darren and I know from like old fashioned Vox, right? It was like we had a brand new media organization. So we had to decide like how would we react to events. And there was like a mass shooting playbook. Right. Yeah. There was like certain events would trigger us scrambling the jets in a particular kind of way with gun content. But it wasn't that every time a person was shot and killed in America, we did that. Right. It's like a call. But then we are like ourselves, we're a fairly influential media organization. And a critical part of the mass shooting news cycle is specifically national media news outlets' decision to scramble the jets and decide that these murders in Boulder, Colorado are national rather than local news, right? And it's very, I have very mixed feelings about the whole thing. Like, I don't know what can be done to stop it, but I just feel like we know, like proof positive, that like whatever that exercise of media agenda setting is supposed to achieve, like it's not achieving that. Like, we're not making policy progress. We're not making people feel better. I don't think we're really contextualizing the problem for people, even though, like, we'll say it's important to contextualize this problem. Like, the fact of the jets scrambling, like, decontextualizes.
Yeah, I don't want to make this too meta media. I think that it's fair to say that that there is a segment of people in the Democratic coalition who were not as informed about gun stuff, or it wasn't as salient to their political identities like a decade or half a decade ago, but it seems like that gap is pretty well closed. I think the other factor here is, frankly, given that new salience of gun violence, in a world where the kind of archetypal big local story that doesn't make national news actually is a big local story, it might very well be that some national outlets see an entrepreneurial advantage in saying, why isn't the media talking about this and like actually making those international news stories? The problem is that we don't have a local news ecosystem that is well equipped to cover even big events with any kind of like serious ground cover or drum beating, much less having the ability to themselves kind of cover it in a sensitive and contextual way that might be seen as worth lifting up by, you know, progressively affiliated news outlets. So it's just, there is a kind of black hole into which a lot of this stuff is disappearing, where in theory, if you asked folks, are you concerned about, you know, weekends in, you know, Chicago or New Orleans, where as many people die in a spree shooting, they will say yes. But in practice, they just aren't having that information surfaced for them.
I also think there's this question here of, do people actually understand the, not just the risk that they're actually at, but also what the policy response would be and mean for them in order to stop that from being afraid? Because I think that politicians have made the calculation and there's no point in like actually making this real argument, which is like, hey, if you want to stop this, it would mean a massive gun buyback program, and that drawing that link for people that this is the only viable solution to the problem that you are scared of is not something that I've ever seen Democratic or Republican politicians actually do. And I think if that's the situation that we're in, like, I don't actually think that you can fully even blame people who are like telling their kids to learn about like hiding under your desks in school or like all this kind of stuff, because there's never been any kind of clear policy link drawn for the average person about how to stop the things that you're scared of. And we're repeatedly telling people again and again that there are these smaller nibbles that we can make at the basket, whether it's closing the Charleston loophole that would have stopped what happened in Charleston several years ago from happening. happening. And then that could have stopped that from happening because that's how he bought his gun, or other loopholes. And it feels really weird because at the same time, all these politicians seem to recognize that even these small nibbles at the edges of gun policy are not actually going to happen. So they're able to say something that's not super radical, not something that's going to cause any kind of real harm to their political prospects. But at the same time, they're actually confusing the entirety of their base, who really truly believes that you can actually stop these problems with these small changes, which then leads me to see like tons of tweets or like Instagram posts from my friends. They're just like, why can't we just pass this small thing? We all know how to make it happen. And the reality is this is not going to do anything to solve the major problem here. And I think it's really important to drill down into, you know, there are also other scenarios. I think we talked about risk assessments a lot this year with COVID, where people have, I think, somewhat of a better understanding of risk assessments this year when it comes to like, you know, I can wear a mask and I'm not going to hurt other people or all this kind of stuff. But at the very beginning, it was kind of a free-for-all because people had no idea how to actually keep themselves safe. So, you know, I had friends of mine who wouldn't go anywhere without wearing gloves all the time. And, you know, you would take off all your clothes when you got into the hallway of your apartment or whatever. And so there's this question here of if you're going to give people actual risk mitigation strategies, you have to be honest with them about what that actually is, or you're going to lead to completely irrational behaviors that are going to become then part of people's political identities because they think it's going to stop kids from dying. And that's just like not true. And then the entire conversation is removed from reality.
Okay. I think it's we're overdue for a break. Then I want to try to pivot this conversation in a controversial way to Atlanta.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So we were joking around about Nirvana before. And one thing I remember from the 90s is that there was a lot of violent crime in the United States at that time. The murder rate was very high. You know, we talked about the Sandy Hook era. And then the sort of like the pre-Sandy Hook, like lull in gun politics. But the era in which the U.S. government was in fact passing laws to restrict firearms ownership was the early 90s. And it was part of a general tough on crime politics, right? And so like Joe Biden was both a leading proponent of assault weapons ban and also a leading proponent of longer jail sentences for people, right? This was the infamous, quote unquote, 1994 crime bill, like did all these things. And it was understood at the time to be a measure backed by progressive Democrats. This was their big package to put more cops on the street, to fund more construction of jail cells, like spending money like liberals do, and also banning gun ownership like liberals do. And it was popular at the time because people were really, really upset about crime in general. Sandy Hook happened at a time when people weren't upset about crime in general. So it became this sort of niche gun topic. And then we had this shooting in Atlanta, which prompted this. I think if you like came down from Mars, you would be confused as to why there was this like vicious debate as to whether or not we should construe this as an anti-Asian bias crime, in which nobody like quite states like what are the stakes of characterizing this as a hate crime? Like what happens if it's a hate crime? Who does that help? What's going on, right? And I think, though, that dispute, it's tied in with the fact that we've seen an increase in lethal violence across the board in 2020. And there's sort of issues about how that's going to be processed politically. With one concern that was happening was that Asian American communities in the Bay Area were, you know, getting into tough on crime politics as a result of seeing people victimized in Chinatown and in Oakland and San Francisco, and an increase in concern about anti-Asian hate crimes was part of a sort of progressive counter-mobilization to the idea of tough on crime politics in Asian American neighborhoods. At least that's how I read it. I don't know if you guys agree with that.
Well, just to take a step back here, I think a lot of times people actually are not really aware of what hate crimes actually are. So a hate crime is not just someone, you know, maybe yelling a slur or saying something offensive or horrible or targeted about you, about your race, but it is someone committing a crime while with the intent of harming someone because of a protected class that they belong to. So these are obviously incredibly hard things to track. It is really difficult to know whether or not someone has committed a hate crime, because frequently someone's not going to say, "Hi, I'm about to like beat you up because you are part of the Asian American community," or whatever. Frequently, it just kind of happens that you commit a crime and people are like not actually telling you why they're doing it. And you don't actually have an understanding of why it happened. And also, there are a lot of people who are victimized who don't actually want to report. So what we've seen this year is there's a massive increase in reporting of not just anti-Asian hate crime specifically, but also harassment. Stop AAPI Hate is an organization that's been doing a lot of the tracking here. And all of it is self-reported, and it's anonymous, at least to us. I'm not sure if they're collecting the data on the back end for themselves, but it's anonymized to the public, the data. And a lot of these things are things that likely would not rise to the level of being a hate crime. They are things that are horrible and offensive, and there maybe could be policy responses to reduce anti-Asian sentiment, but aren't actually criminal activity as defined by, you know, states and the federal government. But there's some of this secondary question that people have been bringing up, like, oh, well, we've seen an increase in crime. So like all this stuff clearly is just about, you know, increasing crime. And like, we don't actually know whether or not Asian Americans are specifically being targeted. I think this is probably like taking leave of your senses entirely to believe something like this. I think we have clear data from across the world that anti-China sentiment has been on the rise over the last 3 years. This is not an American only phenomenon. This is something we're seeing in Australia. We're seeing it in Sweden. We're seeing it in Canada. We're seeing it in all these places around the world. You know, I think part of it is inevitable. A pandemic happened that originated in a country and has wreaked economic devastation. And irrationally or rationally, people are going to blame that country for the place that they find themselves in. But there's secondarily, you know, a different thing in the U.S. context and in other contexts around the world, where people have also been, you know, we saw the Trump administration blaming China frequently. We saw Trump utilizing things, calling it the China virus, or you know, kind of stigmatizing people from that background. And we also know that, you know, frequently people who are angry in this way do not differentiate between Chinese Americans or Japanese Americans when they're looking for someone to blame or anger that they have. And I think that there's enough anecdotal evidence at this point that the burden of proof ought to be on people to say that, like, to prove there isn't an increase in anti-Asian sentiment that is fueling some hate crimes. But then there's this, like, you know, question of, like, why is this actually so important? And, you know, I pull a lot of my understanding from this is, like, work that Herman Lopez has done for Vox. So definitely read his stuff. But, you know, one thing that you can point to is that hate crime legislation also provides funding to police departments for liaisons to communities like the LGBTQ community or other groups of people so that police can actually work with them and make sure that they're actually hearing about these crimes to begin with and know what's actually going on. It's unlikely that hate crime laws by themselves are actually doing anything outside of that to curb hate crimes. A lot of them are just enhancements. So you add like 5 or 10 or whatever, so many years onto someone's sentence if they're convicted of a hate crime. And we know from the data that like the length of the sentence does very little to deter crime. It's only but the certainty of whether or not you're going to get caught. But there is a benefit there. And there's also, I think, the secondary benefit as well about Asian American communities are scared. There is a reality here that people are terrified about this. And, you know, I've seen a lot of people say like, oh, I know it doesn't, like, maybe it's not fully rational, but I'll only go to Asian grocery stores now. And that's a fear that has to be addressed. And I think that that's something that's important. And it's important that Joe Biden gets out there and says, you know, we're not going to stand for this. Asian American people belong here. It's important that other leaders are getting up and saying that from across the country. But I think the problem happens when that stops there, when we stop at this question of like telling people they belong and don't move on to like, what is the policy response to both A, reduce hate and B, reduce hate crimes. And I think that's kind of where we're in limbo here, because a lot of the responses may not be people don't like to talk about crime.
Right. I mean, framing the concept of a hate crime as a concept invented by and for law enforcement for the purpose of asking for more harsh punishment for things that are already theoretically going to be prosecuted is really important to kind of understanding the relationship between discourse and policy here, right? Because, you know, in the couple of decades since the 90s, there has been increasing awareness of the empirical trends that Jerusalem was talking about, among people in the center and to the left of that, that like sentencing enhancements aren't a deterrent, that they're not, that if your goal is to, you know, to reduce crime or to kind of optimize your crime policy for crime rates, that that's not where you should be looking. I've generally felt that if you just construe criminal justice policy in that way, you're going to end up making people feel a little bit lacking, because there is a feeling among most people that there are things that deserve punitive responses for moral purposes or for expressive, like, we the community are saying this is bad purposes. And so that if you don't allow that to be part of the discourse, that people will like find other ways to kind of ferry those things in. And that's a little bit of what we're seeing right now, where as people have become a little bit more aware of these tools aren't everything they were cracked up to be, and as people in the Democratic coalition have become much more skeptical of the law enforcement establishment to be able to protect in particular vulnerable communities in the rubric of racial justice, an increasing interest in calling out racism and using explicit terms to do so. And this is also a little bit paradoxical, because it's coming at a time when more and more people are fluent in concepts like structural racism and aware that you don't necessarily have to harbor racial animus at the individual level to participate in systems that perpetuate racial inequity. At that same time, there is an increasing interest in calling out things that are racist, and a sense that if you are unwilling to use terms like racism or targeting, that that is an act of, you know, cowardice masquerading as nuance. And so in the kind of 24, 48 hours after the Atlanta shooting, there was an interest in, you know, you could kind of see discursively this motion toward the best way to stand with AAPI Americans and with the victims of this is to use words like, you know, is to say things like, obviously these people were being, you know, this was deliberate, this was targeting, this was a hate crime, which plays into and is has its origins in this law enforcement tool that then when it became explicit, people were very skeptical of, right? The idea that, of course, we shouldn't be trusting the police, we shouldn't be trusting prosecutors to give us an accurate sense of what motivated this person, when that's really the only, you know, certainly the only policy relevant purpose, arguably the only purpose of calling something a hate crime in particular. And it is worth considering, I think, the ways in which people have already the tools to do this a little bit, maybe differently and arguably better, to think about, it's not like hate crime labels are the only discursive tools that we have to talk about racial inequities. It's not like that's the only tool we have to talk about the history of Asian women in sex work and sex work adjacent industries, to talk about labor exploitation, to talk about the other things that you didn't need to know anything about the circumstances of this to be able to talk about, you know, a broader history of inequality. Because of the desire for bold language and clear denunciation, there is an interest in using the rhetorical tools available to us, which happen to be, in this case, law enforcement sentencing enhancement tools that were last popular in the 1990s and 2000s.
And I will say, too, that I think the focus on discourse is one that comes out of a kind of murky policy area. Like people, I think if there was a very clear actions to be taken, people would have taken them already and there would be like easy and politically salient people would just talk about it. But people don't actually know how to just reduce. I mean, the majority of these incidents are just harassment incidents that are terrible, that make you feel unsafe, that make you feel worried. But, you know, you can't prosecute someone for like saying a slur. Like that's just not something that you know, I mean, you can, but you probably are going to lose. There are very few laws or officers, police officers that are going to do that. And so people don't know how to react to these situations. And so instead, there's this massive focus on making sure people are saying the right things. And I don't actually think frequently it's at the expense of a policy debate. It is following the lack of a clear policy debate that you get this focus on discourse.
I will also say, just because it's like, I would be remiss in not pointing this out, that I think AAPI writers over the last week have done a lot of real work to model a much more substantive way of talking about this, whether that's kind of nuanced discussions of, you know, the relationship between paranoia and feeling legitimately targeted over the last year, you know, whether that's talking about, you know, there was a really excellent Refinery 29 essay that put forward a very specific political agenda in the service of saying, you know, this is what a real racial justice agenda would look like, but that at least is, you know, putting a policy framework into a debate that feels serious enough to be about policy, but doesn't always have that substance to it.
I mean, again, just as a media thing, like, I feel like it's a shame that, like, it takes, or it's seen to take, something like a spree killing in Atlanta to generate, like Lee Zhou's article about the history of anti-Asian racism in the United States that was published on Vox, because it's a really wonderful article, and hanging it out there that way, though, makes it like appear more dependent for its relevance on specific, still not really known facts about a particular case, right? And so something I had no idea until this past week, that subsequent investigation indicates that the Pulse nightclub shooting that happened years and years ago was not in any way motivated by anti-LGBT sentiment, that was just a misunderstanding, and he actually picked a club at random without any knowledge that it was a gay club. And so, like, I had no idea. Whatever gestures of solidarity I made with the LGBT community at that time are still completely valid, though, right? Like, it doesn't, like, the one thing actually has nothing to do with the other. But it's challenging in a social media era, like, as a journalist. Like, I am now trying to do a better job than I did in the Pulse era of, like, withholding judgment on what actually happened in Atlanta. But I don't want that to be read as like in a lack of solidarity, but that's what it is, you know. And lots of people, like most people saying things on social media, are not journalists. And so it's like, yeah, like if you are a state representative in Texas, I mean, you shouldn't lie to people, but like your first obligation probably is to just demonstrate solidarity with people feeling alarmed and then to think of, do you have any constructive policy ideas? But it's like now I feel both torn between a desire to like pump the brakes on, you know, over ascription of motive, but also appreciating that a lot of AAPI journalists have written good articles. I feel like maybe people have had something on their chests that they like kind of wanted to say without stepping on George Floyd related narratives, but like about themselves and their cultures and their communities. And now this is an opportunity to give voice to that. But I also don't want to see it all like collapse like a house of cards if some more specific information comes out and it turns out it's not that. I also know, I mean, I follow on Twitter this woman, Ayella, who is like a sex work influencer or something. And like she's been really upset at the like lack of solidarity toward sex workers as such during this kind of thing. And it's like, I totally see where she's coming from. Like, I think like her read of it is a very natural read of this specific set of events, particularly if you come to it with her particular set of concerns and identities rather than the ones that are currently predominating. And I think if you read the article that Jerusalem wrote with Rachel Ramirez about Black Asian solidarity, that came out, I think, before the Atlanta shooting, but like, knowledge that that work was happening and that this was a thing people were concerned about helps understand why there has been so much emphasis on like one particular angle here, where you had a horrific killing of Asians with a white perpetrator. It fits well into certain kinds of solidarity work that were happening. And we just weren't having a national argument about sex work and sex workers like the week before this happened. So there's nothing to say about it or to do, but it's very, I don't know. It's like people have a lot of like real feelings bound up in this stuff, as well as real policy equities. And I think it's like, The more like detached I've become from needing to participate in the viral media economy, like the more uncomfortable I get constantly watching these things unfold. Because like then I want to say to everybody else who's critical of these trends, it's like, look, like this is a golden opportunity to like get good traffic to good articles about history and things that are happening. So like, what do you want people to do? Like, why should you plop down a story about the history of the Asian American experience at a time when nobody's going to read it? Like, of course you put it out when there's audience interest.
Yeah, this is the thing. And like, you know, not to make this too much about the business of media, but like, I think about this in the context of the constant 2015 to 2020 to like January 2021 genre that was write up the Trump tweet, because that is known to be something that people genuinely want to read, that it was like a popular Google trend routinely in like mid-morning to midday of any given weekday during Trump's presidency. And the challenge in that kind of content is to turn it into something that is actually going to give people usable information after the tweet itself is forgotten. And that's, you know, that like, that's a skill that you can develop as a journalist. If you have a certain amount of understanding of the subject matter, you can like figure out what the policy substrate is, or you can connect the dots to things that are broader and more important. That risks, of course, the idea that connection is the only connection that can be drawn, or that is like the motivation of it, which, you know, I think is relevant both to the like, what Matt was talking about with Pulse, and more recently, you know, there was a wave of content about the history of justified Black distrust of the medical establishment, with the kind of policy hook of vaccine hesitancy, which neither properly stated where vaccine hesitancy was most concentrated, nor was it necessarily something that the actual like Black Americans who were wary of taking the vaccine were thinking about. Like, you know, I think we may have talked about this on the podcast. Matt certainly talked about it on his newsletter, but like, there was a really good article actually going to people who have been working with Black communities and saying, yeah, they don't know the Tuskegee experiment. They have much more contemporary concerns about the way they've been treated as Black patients. But it's still useful history, right? And it's a useful opportunity, and not something that, you know, there is a media equivalent of never waste a crisis, right? And it's not, let's use this to push our preferred political agenda, but let's use this to level some people up on knowledge that they don't otherwise seek out and should be, and now are going to have the opportunity to carry with them.
And I think here it's useful to dig down on obligations of different groups that we're all talking about here, because we've talked a lot about the media, but, you know, a lot of times media sometimes is worried about trying to calibrate, like, oh, like if you think that the vast majority of your audience or Americans are unaware of anti-Asian racism, then you're going to use this as an opportunity to talk about that. If you are really worried about the not understanding about sex work, then you're going to use it as an opportunity to talk about that, or violence against women, talk about that. And then that ends up being, you know, an issue because, like, let's say you're calibrating incorrectly for your audience, or other people are like, why is everyone talking about racism when this is this other problem here that's important? And all of these things are true independently, but then it becomes a massive calibration problem if all of the media is calibrating in one direction. You don't actually get the heterodoxy of many different views kind of bringing all of these issues to the forefront. And then there's a secondary question of, like, what do individuals in the situation have an obligation to, right? And I think individuals actually have been very, very good. Like, you don't have, like, the political power to, like, pass a law or anything like that, but donations we've seen in the last year have just skyrocketed on GoFundMe, on BLM groups, or to other people. People are using this as an opportunity, like, hey, I'm just going to put my money where my mouth is. I'm going to send it to groups, and that's how I'm going to productively engage with these issues. And, you know, we're seeing this here too. Like, people were sending money to different Asian American groups that were doing work on this, whether it was to AAPI.org or the actual family members of individuals who are harmed. And that's allowed individuals to actually engage in a way that is fulfills their obligation to society and also make sure that they're expressing solidarity to their friends. And then there's this question of, like, what do policymakers have an obligation to? I think here with policymakers and with, like, activist groups is where we're seeing the actual real failure here, because I don't think individuals have the obligation to, like, research the exact effective policies to, like, lower hate crimes and, like, call up their senators. I don't think that, like, you can even put that on an individual at all. But activist groups that are ostensibly saying that their goals are to lower these things from happening do have an obligation to hold politicians accountable if all they're doing is talk. And I think the issue here is, and I mean, this is a much bigger, probably its own podcast here, is, like, there's obviously a ton of, like, capture being done between the Democratic Party and its activist groups and the Republican Party and its activist groups. Like, these are people who get to work in both of these spaces all the time. And, like, a lot of times people are much more concerned with maintaining relationships than holding people to accountability. And that's, like, a structural problem and not, like, anything about any individual person working in this space. But because those incentives exist, no one is really, incentivized to ensure that when someone gets out there and says, we need to stop Asian American violence, that a reporter immediately goes, okay, here are three policies that can be passed immediately to stop this from happening. Do you support any of these? And really hold them feet to the fire. And I think that, like, there are some places where media can definitely do better here. But I think the real problem here is that, and this is something that's beyond even these hate crimes, is that we've allowed people for too long to just give lip service to the things that they're talking about and not actually discuss what they're willing to give up, whether it's their own political capital in one issue or another, to actually pass the policies here. And I think that, you know, there's an obligation here on activist groups to make sure that it's not just policing what people are saying, which is important, make sure people aren't saying offensive things, but also what they're doing.
I mean, I think that it's also possible that it's also worth considering the possibility that, politically speaking, among not activists, but the broader public, lip service is sufficient, right? Like, if we frame the problem to be the subjective lived experience of fear, then maybe it makes sense that having people in power express, I know that you're suffering right now, and it is a matter of concern for me, and I'm tracking this, might actually be descriptively a sufficient response for those people, might help them feel less vulnerable, less marginalized, less ignored, but might also be, in some cases, better than trying to use a blunt policy instrument to deal with this kind of difficult subjective, you know, relative risks problem. I'm like, I'm not expressing a position on that one way or the other, but it's possible that while activists have a very strong incentive to turn any lip service commitment into a policy commitment, that that isn't actually the way the broader dynamic is going to work.
I think that's a really smart take, but I also think that that's a question of, you know, do we choose to view these things as natural disasters or human caused events? And I think that, like, you know, if there was, like, a flood and there's nothing you could do about it and it just happened, then yeah, it's enough to have that happen and then hope hopefully you get like FEMA resources or whatever it is to help you in the aftermath. But in that moment, like no one's blaming you for not like stopping a flood from occurring. But that's, I think, what's really weird here is that we started viewing like mass shootings and like other things like this as like just natural disasters that we have no control over.
But I think this is an important part of the progressive contention about anti-Asian violence, is the claim that specifically Donald Trump's words about the virus are a key causal factor here, or perhaps his lack of words on the other side, right? That like, but I mean, every article that I read from a progressive perspective about anti-Asian hate crimes references Trump calling it the China virus, right? Or Trump saying Kung Flu, right? So a central implicit claim is that we would not be having this if Trump had not said those things, or perhaps if he had gone in solidarity to, I don't know, he could have gone to the Eden Center and gotten some banh mi and, you know, stood with the Vietnamese American, because it's a very actual Republican community out there of Asian Americans. And he didn't do those things. And so possibly that would have made a difference. I've also seen the claim be made that not just the sort of specific grossness of the Kung Flu, but that like generalized foreign policy rhetoric suggesting tensions between the United States and the People's Republic of China is a big cause, right? So like I had a friend get scolded the other day for praising a Chuck Schumer bill that's about our scientific research competitiveness with China. And Spencer Ackerman, who's got a good book coming out about the war on terror and its domestic consequences, he did a vicious subtweet of me saying that, you know, when you try to say that competition with China will build solidarity in the United States, you're putting your Asian neighbors at risk. Those are all, I don't know, like empirical claims that I have not seen super strong efforts to measure. It seems plausible-ish. Like they're not crazy claims, but like they're also not obviously true. And I think in this case, it's not just that like, well, it's words rather than policy. It's a specific claim that the words are the policy, right? And then there was a New York Times article saying that activists, left-wing activists, were very upset at Andrew Yang's policy proposals on Asian hate crimes because those proposals involved like more NYPD patrols in Chinatown. So it was like progressives saying the opposite of what you often hear. It wasn't like match your words with your actions. It was like, no, like do more words. Like we don't like these proposed actions because they're not progressive, right? Like what we want you to do is to take Asian Americans' fear, give voice to it, express solidarity, say that racism is bad, and be careful in how you characterize criticism of the People's Republic of China so as to not like inspire anti-Asian hatred. But it's like progressives actually don't want tangible, concrete policy changes in this regard.
I don't know if that's fair.
It seems to me that the main ones that are on the table are like fairly carceral in their orientation.
Well, I think they have ones that like, you know, perhaps you would disagree with. Things like, you know, I think defund the police is clearly a progressive rallying cry here. And then funding then, you know, other institutions that they think would provide services. I mean, that's clearly been like the progressive rallying cry of the last year. I think it's been repeated in the wake of this stuff. I mean, there's an argument about whether or not that would actually do the thing that we're trying to get it to
do. Well, but I mean, but like nobody is looking at this Atlanta shooter and saying, oh, well, like if only we'd given him affordable housing, he wouldn't have done this, right? Like, it's actually like a strong, I think, like counterpoint to the social services as a substitute for law enforcement kind of view, right? Because like the whole point is that he's motivated by hatred, right? Not by economic deprivation.
I mean, I do think that we to steel man what the argument is here. The argument is that if you were to, on average, make sure that people's economic and, you know, social needs were being met more comprehensively, healthcare, all these kinds of things, that would foster a situation where there would be less hate. Like, we know that people who are not, who are in situations where they had the access to education, access to healthcare, access to all these things, like the higher up the income ladder you go, the less likely you are to be committing violent crimes or being a victim of violent crimes. Like, these are all things that we know are true. So, like, I mean, the argument I don't think progressives are making is that if you give them affordable housing, that he would not have done something, but that there would be fewer incidents of crime if you were to take care of those social determinants of crime.
And, I mean, that's not a specific response.
I mean, it is a specific response.
I mean, I think the other argument here is a kind of, you know, and this is a very robust theory of like how change works, that, you know, it obviously has a lot of like empirical corollaries that could be and aren't necessarily tested. But, you know, the problem is the conjunction of state power and the use of that power to target or marginalize particular groups, right? That if you no longer have a state apparatus that is capable of inflicting state violence on Asian American sex workers or, you know, on more broadly speaking, like non-white Americans, depending on how you construe state violence and what you're pointing at in particular, that you are not going to empower vigilante actors who feel, you know, who feel simpatico with the aims of the state. That's, again, it's like, it's a very specific argument about how things work, but it is, that's kind of the vision there. Now, if we're at an argument about the transformation of society, is that in any way disaggregable into particular policy proposals? I don't know. And I think that that's kind of, that's going to be a question that we're going to have to see as the defund the police meme kind of hits the point where it has to, where it would be expected to move beyond memetude. You know, the difficulty of a revolutionary vision of society coming up with concrete policy asks is, you know, what we were kind of talking about at the beginning of the episode, as far as guns is concerned, but even more broadly, right? Like, if what you actually want is a society where people no longer feel that gun ownership is important to them, it's very hard to turn that into, here are specific ways we can reduce gun prevalence.
Yeah. And I think one thing that, Matt, I think that you'll hopefully agree with this too, is like, yes, it is the case that like none of these groups are actually arguing over the policy as much as they are arguing over the discursive elements that we're talking about here. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I think that if Andrew Yang had come out and been like, let's go defund the police, like, I don't think that they would have opposed his policies here. So I think I think the part that I'm disagreeing with is not that they disagree with Andrew Yang's policies, but that they don't have any policy aims of their own when they do that. There are obviously a lot of research proving that you do want to have some level of police engagement.
No. I agree with that. But what I'm saying is that there's not a, if you go to the Stop AAPI Hate website, right, and you know, you see what they're doing, right? So they are assembling statistics on hate crimes. They have safety tips in your community. They are encouraging you to support Asian businesses in your community, you know, like, which is all good stuff. And they're saying that people should condemn anti-Asian hate, ask your elected officials what they're doing to increase resources for survivors and their families. And then they say, well, there should be anti-racism education in schools, that there should be ethnic studies curricula. It's a very words-based framework. Like, it's not that it's like words rather than actions. It's that like the actual group, the institution that progressive Asian groups have stood up to like be their entry point for the problem. Like, they want, you know, concerned grandmas in Chinatowns across America to be funneled toward Stop AAPI Hate to look for solutions. And the solutions they are putting on the table are very discoursey oriented ones. Like, that's their theory of the case. Right? That, like, you know, we need to address the perpetual foreigner stereotype that frames Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders as outsiders to this nation. Like, that's their diagnosis of the problem, right? That there is a sort of a discourse framing of Asian American individuals as not really Americans. And we need to challenge that in the context of broad anti-racism education. And that is the root cause of the problem, rather than offer some more specific, and I think they would think less progressive view, like, we need more foot patrols in the neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, there's clearly a blind spot when it comes to, I wouldn't say blind spot. I think it's a really tough policy area when it comes to crime in progressive spaces, especially because there is such a disconnect between a lot of the communities that are experiencing a lot of the crime and a lot of the advocacy groups on both sides who are, you know, usually not experiencing crime if you're someone who's working at a policy advocacy group in DC or New York City. And I think there's a disconnect there, but I also just think that, you know, I think it is not fully sufficient to say that it is only discursive to direct funds to people who are survivors or that there should be changes in how education is done. I mean, for instance, it is clearly the case, and as someone who attended school in William & Mary in Southern Virginia, that the way that the Civil War has been taught in schools has really affected the way people think about race relations in America and even that fundamental understanding of American history. And that has clear implications for how people form their politics later in life. You know, I met several people who genuinely fully believed that Robert E. Lee did not support slavery in the slightest. And I, you know, this is very confusing conversations I would have these folks. But I mean, I think that that's like not irrelevant to how we talk about things. And the fact that, you know, in many public schools, Asian Americans as a historical part of the American context is not discussed. The idea that there were Asian Americans here for hundreds of years is not discussed. And I think that it is obvious that there needs to be more here. If you're talking about the literal crimes that are being committed against Asian Americans, you need to do something about making sure that people are literally protected on a day-to-day basis. But I think it is unfair to say that there is not a structure, that there are not structural other issues that can be addressed through things like education policy and funding for survivors of these attacks.
All right, we're deep into this. better take another break and do the paper.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prop G Pod, we bring you insights from Blue Flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. Super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the dog.
So this week's white paper is called Charismatic Authority in Fractured Polities, a Cross-National Analysis by Andrew P. Davis and Luis Vila Henninger of North Carolina State University and the Institut de Sciences Politiques Louvain Europe, apparently. I apologize for my terrible French. It's an interesting paper, not something, it's cross-national sociology, which is not something we usually do on the podcast, that basically marries an extremely fancy correlation with, you know, a lot of regression analysis of a data set that is compiled by asking a bunch of experts to rate their country's politics on various scales, including, you know, measures of, most saliently for this, political polarization, with a theory of leadership that is most commonly associated with Max Weber, which is why I chose this paper, because I've been waiting for an excuse for Matt and me to talk about Weber in a white paper context for ages and ages, that describes one of the forms of political authority as charismatic, very much in the body of the leader, in his individual personality. And for that reason, something that is a little bit more difficult than other forms of authority to turn into a durable political institution. And so this paper marries a pretty robust theoretical analysis of, you know, here are some ways that in a partisan political context, a charismatic leader could increase political polarization, with the descriptive finding that over this big cross-national data set, it is in fact the case that when these experts are asked to, you know, express how much the leader of their country is seen as the kind of the defender, the hero, the savior, the more likely they are to agree with that sentiment, they are more likely in subsequent years to agree that their politics have become polarized. It is certainly I think that there are you know, methodological limitations, and also that like that they themselves are acknowledged that the theory could also work the other way, that a transformational leader could also reduce political polarization. But certainly in the ways that they are describing the particular mechanisms of, you know, how a charismatic leader could come into conflict with party authorities, or what sorts of sentiments and modes of discourse they could inspire in their followers and their opponents, there are very obvious relevances to certain recent American presidents who amazingly are not mentioned in the paper.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting, most interesting things about this paper for me was this idea of if someone comes into your organization with all this charisma and has the ability to get a lot of buy-in from the people or from the lower masses who would make up your organizations, let's say you're Trump and this is the Republican Party that we're talking about, and then it's obviously going to come into conflict inevitably with the existing power structures that don't rely on charisma, that rely on things like Reince Priebus being the head of the RNC or other individuals who have things like their senators or their governors, and they're getting that from the legal authority that they get from those roles specifically. Because it is threatening, because if you see that your people who you're supposed to have authority over are turning to another individual who has no allegiance to the actual structures that uphold your authority, which means that that person's necessarily going to come into conflict with you. I think Trump is like an example of this, obviously, but I think also I was thinking a lot about just other progressive individuals like AOC and Bernie, who have very strong attachments to their base and are able to and do come into conflict even when they are aligned with Democratic Party principles on a lot of issues with individuals who are much more tied to the existing power structures that give them the authority.
Yeah, I actually think it might be worth reading a bit, like this, just to make it clear that Jerusalem and I are not reading something into this paper that does not exist. Like, there are passages in here, you know, charismatic authority is based on the heroic feats of the leader and the loyalty of followers. If followers are not dogmatic, this raises doubts about the heroic status of the leader, which threatens the survival of the charismatic leader. In this frame, either the leader is a hero or is a charlatan. Like, that kind of thing, the personalization of politics around these charismatic figures. And Jerusalem, I think that, you know, the kind of Bernie AOC equivalent on the among Democrats is absolutely legit, that, you know, those tend to take the form of turning procedural fights over how delegates are counted, over who the party supports in primaries, which generally follow institutional bureaucratic rules, into referenda on, oh, if you like this politician, then you must support this side of the fight. And if you're deferring to the standard bureaucratic logic, it must be because of personal animus toward that politician. Yeah. That absolutely can, that we're seeing that kind of reduce in the aggregate the institutional power that the party has, because it's just so much more compelling to define yourself as for or against the politician who's kind of coming up against them.
But I also want to note that this is a it's a style of followership, at least as much as of leadership. And so, like, an interesting thing is that when moderate Senate Democrats say they won't overrule the parliamentarian and force this $15 an hour thing into the stimulus bill, Bernie Sanders, who, you know, chairs the budget committee, who has this kind of charismatic authority, he chooses not to wield it, right? Like, he reiterates his support for the $15 an hour minimum wage, but he does not blow it up, right? He makes statements that encourage his followers to think of this as a disagreement that is, like, bounded in nature, not worth blowing up the legislation over, and, like, onward we go, right? But he doesn't not have the charismatic authority, right? Like, he happens to wield it in a more measured way than Donald Trump does, is selective. I mean, it's not that he doesn't create blowups, sometimes irresponsible ones, but he is selective about it, right? And it's part of what makes him an important figure, right, sort of in American history, because he has a fair amount of sort of like self-conscious control over how these sluice gates work. Though it also makes you wonder what a Sanders presidency would be like, right? My like optimistic case for Bernie, which you can look up on the internet, was in part exactly about this, right? That my view of him is that as president, he would have wielded this authority in the kind of measured way that we've seen from him as a senator. And it ultimately would have wound up being institution bolstering. It's a way to get people who don't... I am inclined to believe that, like, when things don't happen, it's because the structural obstacles are, in fact, large. Many of the people who love Bernie Sanders are inclined to believe that when things don't happen, it's because of betrayal at the part of, you know, Barack Obama or Joe Biden or something else like that. Bernie, to me, is somebody who can bring people along and, like, get them to accept the compromise that led to the American Rescue Plan. The thesis of this paper is that, like, that's not correct, or at least not systematically correct, and that when you empower the charismatic leaders, they, I don't quite want to say inevitably, but at least, like, statistically, what they do is sort of, like, burn the system down. It's interesting, like, Joe Biden is the least... I don't just want to say, like, he's a low charisma politician, because he's charming in his way. But I think in the Weberian sense, he is less of a charismatic leader, not just than Trump, but then Obama, then George W. Bush, then Bill Clinton. I'm not 100% sure about the Clinton judgment, but definitely than the other 21st century leaders. He is not the savior of the nation. He's not the father of his people. He has a lot of supporters, but he gets very little reflexive deference from them. I think that if he tried to pivot Democratic Party ideology in, like, a weird way, he would not succeed in that. Right. Like, people like him because he supports the ideas that they like, or they don't like him because he doesn't. But, you know, it's different from, like, I think Obama and Bush and Trump, all in their different ways, could, like, sell people on weird ideas. Right. Like, the United States needs to export democracy globally through a series of wars. It was, like, a totally out of left field, like, George W. Bush idea that dominated American foreign policy for a long time, because especially after 9/11, he was America, right? And he wielded that power. Biden, I think, can't do that. Does that actually make politics less polarized? I guess, like, the jury's out, but as of March 23rd, I don't see it.
So I looked into the actual data set that they're getting this from. They it's called VDEM, and they have this variable there that they're trying to track. And it's very subjective, this idea of whether or not you're giving deference to this chief executive. And so I was like, how are they getting this from? Apparently, they're gathering data from 5 experts for each observation, which makes me a little bit skeptical. Like, who are these experts? Maybe it's somewhere in there. I couldn't find it. But who are these experts? Like, are these all just, like, Americans who are especially attuned to the American context, or, like, whatever? Like, where are they coming from?
And also, how charismatic are the experts?
Exactly.
Like, how much do we defer to them?
And on top of that, too, like, I thought, like you did, Matt, that, you know, there would be some, like, really large bump for George W. Bush, at least, especially post 9/11. I thought that would be there, but, like, it's not there at all. Like, you don't even have, like, much larger ratings of charisma for Bush or for Obama. It kind of just jumps when we get to Trump. At least, I mean, you only have it on a yearly basis, so you can't track exactly when they get into office or anything like that. But that's something it's very interesting to me, to think about how they're actually discussing this, because to them it seems that Trump is this massively charismatic leader, but you don't have any kind of look at Obama or other folks. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, clearly, I don't think anyone called Obama God Emperor of the United States, as they refer Trump to sometimes on these right-wing forums. But I do think that there is maybe a usage of the word charisma here that might be confusing to folks. Like, when we're talking about it in this sense, it's not just like, oh, you have, like, you're, like, you know, you're engaging to talk to, or you seem smart. It's like it comes from a religious context originally, where someone was endowed with this kind of, like, extraordinary power or extraordinary ability beyond that which is given to average individuals. So there's something else going on there. And I also would say, too, that the conflict with the traditional authority figures is not one that is only on the part of the charismatic individual. I think that there's a lot of incentive for people in traditional modes of authority who lack that charismatic authority to push against anyone who might be coming up the ranks with it. So the inevitability of the conflict, I think, may have less to do with, you know, potentially another Bernie Sanders and more to do with, like, are people afraid of losing their power to someone who doesn't even need to get their approval to gain power?
I do want to talk a little
bit. You really see that with AOC.
I do want to talk about the Obama example, because Obama isn't just a matter of personal charm, but, like, actually does fit the Weberian model. You know, the reason you can make an argument for why Barack Obama won the Democratic nomination in 2008, that is that he embodied and expressed a narrative that America could be redeemed and unified, and that he was the person to do it. You know, that's the kind of, like, the Hillary to the knock first expressed by Hillary's camp in the primary, then expressed by Republicans during his presidency, that he saw himself as the Messiah, that he saw himself as a celebrity. That's absolutely a critique of a charismatic politics. And it's interesting that that doesn't then show up in the data, which might very well speak to the fact that experts are likely to talk, that, like, experts may be expressing kind of endogenous biases to themselves as experts, because they're probably mm-hmm. talking to each other and they may be missing things that are happening out in the broader polity. But it's also an interesting question of if you present yourself as a unifying leader, but your opponents don't present you that way, that may scramble the model of charismatic authority that they're putting forward here. Because the model they're putting forward is an explicitly us versus them model of charismatic authority and followership. And that's not necessarily out of the Weber. Mm-hmm. If you have a unifying charismatic authority who is seen, at least initially, by his supporters as a unifier, but not actually treated universally as a unifier. Like, they bring up toward the end of this paper that the analysis of charismatic authority in newly democratic states suggests that charismatic figures can be unifiers. And they're like, well, we're not saying that that finding is wrong, because there's a big difference between newly democratic states and everything we're talking about. But it's also, you know, it is true that if you have someone like Obama in a mature democracy, that there are going to be incentives from the partisan opposition to reject that narrative. And that's then going to scramble, you know, the leader's ability to put forth that narrative of themselves.
I mean, the other thing I was thinking about, right, because I think AOC was such a good example of what Jerusalem was talking about, right, where, like, because she's, like, well-known, right, not just she's like, charismatic, like, gives a good speech, but, like, she has this big social media following, people go to her on Twitch, she has an independent fundraising base. Her stature totally subverts the logic of House leadership, in which your committee assignments are very, very important, and your relationship with the DCCC is very, very important, right? And it's a necessarily conflictual situation. Even if neither she nor Nancy Pelosi particularly wants to fight, the idea of a backbench member of Congress who is extremely well known is antithetical to the way the House is meant to work, right? But it's so intimately tied to changes in the media environment. Right. Like, Weber writes before the rise of broadcast mass media, and AOC exists essentially after, like, broadcast mass media as the dominant form of communication. And I wonder, I mean, I always wonder how much we'll look back on 20th century politics as driven by the sort of unique, specific role of network television, in which, you know, producers could choose to defer to the official logic of the system. And, you know, I mean, it's like Noam Chomsky, manufacturing consent, you know, blah, 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 except, like, maybe in a good way, right? And you now have this very unstable environment. Like, we can sit here, any number of, like, wise political journalists can tell you that, like, what backbench members of Congress tweet is not actually important. But if everybody chooses to follow those tweets and interact with them and listen to the people who are popular on Twitter, then, like, it is what it is, you know, and we need to live in that world of social media charisma rather than the bureaucratic logic.
We should probably close out the podcast then.
Okay. All right. That was a long one, but I think great discussion. Thank you so much, Jerusalem, for joining us. It was really good. Thanks, as always, to our sponsors, to our producer, Eric Janakis, and the Weeds will be back on Friday.